When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hag. I'm bouncing off the walls today, and I'll tell you all why. Because the one, the only, my better half, I'm going to call her my better half, is finally back and I get to podcast with her. Hello, Alex.
Oh my God, this is so weird. This is really weird. What are we doing? I feel so sorry for our guest today. He's probably like, "Oh my God, what are these two like?" We'll be good.
I feel like I'm part of a special thing of the reuniting of long lost friends. So all good.
You are our first recording of 2024. The voice you can hear, everybody, is the lovely Murray Dumb. He's an ancient military historian, an assistant editor of Ancient Warfare magazine, previously written about topics including Alexander the Great, the Peloponnesian War, and the Gothic Wars. He's here today to talk about Finis Britannia. I'm not trying to say that in Latin because it's the equivalent of the first Monday in January. I'm not doing it. Military history of late Roman Britain and the Saxon conquest. Murray, how do you pronounce it?
Finis Britannia. You were very, very close.
Oh, that was something remarkable. You're coming to us from Sydney.
Just add an E on the end of your... Yes, indeed.
Excellent.
Sydney, Australia. So...
We were talking before we were recording, and there was a chance we might hate you because it's midsummer there and 30 degrees, but it's also apparently 80% humidity and flooding nearby. So, we're not so jealous.
Getting all... Excellent. Yes. So it's always very funny because, of course, the time zone. So, you know, it's 9 p.m., your early morning, 10 a.m., I suppose. It's not too early. It's not too bad, but... coordination is always a tricky thing.
Yeah, 10 a.m. for me, 11 a.m. for Alina. So let's get going, I suppose. Like, it's good that this one's military. I'm kind of in my wheelhouse if 2,000 years out at the moment. So let's set the scene.
Nice.
Roman rule in Europe is counting down to the end. But what is going on in Britain at the end of the 3rd century?
Right. So one of the things about Britain is that it's a very productive province for the Roman Empire. They invade Britain in 43 AD and then spend a great deal of effort keeping Britain as part of the Roman Empire for the next 400 years, basically. And in the 3rd century, the problem, of course, is, as always with Britain in military history, is this channel of water that separates it from Europe. And what it means is whenever anyone wants to break away from Roman rule in the edges of the Roman Empire, and Britain is at the far edge of the Western Roman Empire, it's easy to do so because Italy is so far away. And so in the 3rd century, you get several breakaway empires that Britain embraces. There's the empire, the Gallic Empire, it's called, posthumous, and then there's another one, Imperium Britannicum in the late 3rd century as well. And so they basically... embrace this breaking away. And every time that happens, they're brought back into the fold. They're brought back into Britain as a Roman province. And what tends to happen is every time that happens, Britain is split so that we start with one province of Roman Britain, then two, then four, and eventually five, maybe even six, depending on which source you read, as a way of trying to keep Roman Britain as part of Rome and to stop it from embracing usurpers.
So this is going to be like I never went away because I'm going off on a tangent already, Alina.
Love a tangent.
Love it because I've, first of all, there's like two parts to my tangent. One of them is you say problem with the body of water. I say half Napoleon. I have this idea in my head as a 20th century military historian that actually when the Romans first arrived, that Britain was a complete backwater of like nothing. Is that true? And if so, like how has Britain changed under those centuries of Roman rule?
So it's probably not a backwater. Okay. That always helps the Romans say that they've conquered a terra nullius. You know, there was nothing here. We brought you civilization. But what we now know is that there are trade contacts. One of the best sources of tin throughout Europe in the Bronze Age, going back to, you know, 3000 BC, is Cornwall. Cornwall's got amazing trade contacts with all of Europe. So Britain has very complex cultural and trade networks that extend into Europe. Familial ties, cultural ties, political ties. We know that there are politicians in the south of Britain who are requesting assistance from Rome. You know, they're copying Roman coinage. And then when Rome arrives, you sort of have a playing out of intertribal warfare within Britain, using Rome as like the big bodyguard cousin to beat up the person who was nasty to you. And that sort of extends throughout the sort of the tribes of various aspects of Britain. And then Rome thinks it's conquered Britain and it's, you know, civilizing it. And then when the Boudiccan revolt occurs in 60 AD, they're basically rudely awakened that no, in fact, they're not defeated and beaten. They're still willing to assert themselves as independent cultures. And of course, the other thing is that Rome never conquers the far north of Scotland. We have Hadrian's Wall, very obviously, even today, for a very brief period of time. You have the Antonine Wall, which is slightly further north. But Rome doesn't try particularly hard to conquer northern Britain and what is now Scotland because it's too hard to control. They're too rowdy, too rebellious. And so it stops that sort of conquest. So it's a really interesting sort of aspect of the history of Roman Britain. And Britain is incredibly fertile. It's got oysters. It's got lots of material wealth that makes Rome want to keep it part of the empire, even at such cost. You know, there's a permanent garrison in Britain of three legions for most of its history under Rome, which is a huge expense for Rome to sort of keep up the cost. But until the very end of Roman Britain, in the late 4th, early 5th century, that cost is well worth it.
I was gonna say it. So I did the North Coast 500, and I've been to the very top of Scotland and all the way around the top. I was gonna say, like, they're still not civilized up there. I mean, you ask for a pub, and they look at you like you've got two heads.
That was my honeymoon. We went to John O'Groats on, you know, we got married in Yorkshire and then drove around Scotland, and absolutely. But it's one of those things that, again, it's incredibly rich in resources. So if a resource rich province was what Rome was after, surely it was worth pursuing. And, you know, I think one of the Roman way of looking at it is they're too barbarian to conquer. But the northern British way of looking at it is they were very independent and couldn't be cowed, you know, regardless of centuries of Roman occupation. And sure enough, when Rome does leave, they come back down the island with a vengeance.
I wonder if Alex, I'm going to see if Alex has finished ranting and then I might be able to get a word.
It was brilliant that Britain is economically sound, but like you say, I guess like what Britain doesn't have is a massive amount of legions. So if Rome does invest that time and effort in terms of a military presence, then it's going to be very hard to not get involved. And I suppose if they are so distant, how hands-on were they really? Is it easier just to go along with it?
In terms of the locals?
Yeah, in terms of like the economy.
Yeah, I think the Britons get a lot out of being Roman, you know, and from the early 3rd century onwards, the Constitutio Antoniana, as it's called, is where every free citizen of the Roman Empire is a citizen. So they basically, any freeborn person becomes a citizen of Rome, which cynically is about tax income. But in terms of the sort of influence, everyone becomes a Roman citizen with the rights of a citizen. So you've got the entire population of Roman Britain being citizens of the Roman Empire, which is sort of a massive increase in their rights and their, their not only their obligations, but also what they're entitled to. So I think there's benefits. But then at the same time, there's this assertion of nativeness, which rears its head multiple times.
I'm interested in a little bit about conspiracy, because when we talk about it, you know, predominantly we talk about the First World War, we talk about the Second World War, and that is all that we talk about, France, Poland, Yugoslavia, whatever. But there was a conspiracy back in Britain at this time, wasn't there?
There is, it's called that. It's called the Great Conspiracy. What it seems to be is, it's in 367, where it would seem that a whole disparate group of barbarian tribes, both in Britain and on the Rhine and the Danube and elsewhere, coordinate that they will all rebel against Roman rule at the same time. And it's one of those things that a lot of modern ancient historians are not willing to credit, that there's no way that this could be a coordinated effort by barbarian tribes people. They couldn't possibly communicate, keep it secret, and coordinate such a huge rebellion against Rome. And that's interesting because they probably could, and that's the Roman biases coming out, that they wouldn't be possible, they wouldn't be capable of such a concerted effort. But at the same time, that idea that they would coordinate, as opposed to it just being a sort of a series of unfortunate coincidences, that Rome was weak at the time, they'd just gone through a series of emperors who were considered weak, and you'd had the stability of the Constantinian family end in 363, then you have a whole bunch of emperors who don't last very long and are considered not very good. And so it's the perfect time to rebel against Rome when Rome is seen to be weak. And so is it just them rebelling all at once because Rome was perceived to be weak at that time? Or was it, hey, we'll rebel if you rebel, or we'll rebel too, all rebelling at once? And so Rome is stuck. How do we react? Who do we react to first? Which is the biggest threat? So fascinating. You can read it both ways. You can say this is just a series of unfortunate events for Rome, and if you were on the side of the barbarians rebelling, fortunate for them because Rome was weak at the time. Or you can indeed read it as this was a concerted effort to break away from Rome by multiple peoples in northern Europe.
So I guess we need to break it down. First of all, like how you see it, because you're the expert, you've written the book. But so you were saying that, so we've got Britain now with all these splintering sort of rebellions trying to get started and Rome still trying to assert its dominance. But then obviously Rome by the 4th and 5th centuries is falling apart in itself. So this is an outpost of the empire. So how does all that affect Britain and what does it do to how they manage this?
Well, the one of the things, of course, about Roman Britain is it's got this massive military garrison. And as threats in mainland Europe spread, one of the sort of very tempting things to do, and it happens various times in Roman Britain's history, is take troops away from Roman Britain and use them in suppressing revolts elsewhere. The problem is, of course, that Britain then becomes vulnerable and weak. And then what tends to happen is it rebels and asserts its independence, normally with a usurper saying, Rome's abandoned us. It sounds very much like Brexit, unfortunately. Rome's abandoned us. We need to fend for ourselves. Follow me. I will give you security. I will give you prosperity and I'll defend our borders. That lasts for some time. And then Rome goes, right, well, we've dealt with that other threat. No, we're coming back now and taking back what's ours. Sorry, I was doing inverted commas at that point, but my camera's off. So Yes.
Right. So we've talked about this, about Roman rule a little bit, but I want to talk about it a little bit more. And and that's to do with the 4th and the 5th centuries, because the Romans are there not just for like a few hundred years. They're there, well, a few hundred years, a couple of years. They're there for a few hundred years. How did the rule change over this time period?
Well, the fascinating thing about that, of course, is obviously you have the Romanization of Britain in terms of the road structures and in terms of fort building and city building. It's not that they didn't have towns previously. We've got several tribal centres that were towns that then get Romanized with Roman buildings and things like that. But what you have is the Romanization of the population. As I said, they become Roman citizens in the early 3rd century. Many of them embrace that Romanness. And, you know, with all of the villas that survive in, you know, the landscape, which keep turning up almost on a weekly basis, it would seem, with amazing mosaics that have never seen the light of day for 2,000 years, that kind of shows you that there's this embracing of Romanness in Britain. And so it's fascinating when Rome abandons Britain, and that's a very vague, when did this happen? And many historians in the past have given a very precise date. And it would seem now, archaeology tells us that that's not an accurate picture at all. But eventually Rome leaves, and you sort of get the reassertion of a sort of a Britonness, and that's very hard to understand too. And what a lot of sources do is they revert to the tribal organization of pre-Rome, but that's 400 years old. So how likely is it that those tribal connections would reassert themselves? But that tends to be the picture that we get, is that the tribes that were present in Rome before the arrival of the Roman invasion in 43 get reasserted and suggested, which is problematic, because that's probably not what's happening at all. But there is some kind of assertion of we are one. And then, of course, very soon thereafter, you start to get the Saxon, Jute, Angle, Frisian, Frank invasions, which start to encroach. And there's this resistance of Britons defending against foreign invasion.
It's really fascinating that you say 400 years has elapsed, and it's not like 400 years now where we could go, oh, well, we'll go to the National Archives and see what they've got there at this point in time. 400 years may as well be 4,000 years, I guess. I mean, we're looking at oral history, aren't we, and tradition. So, and also as well, there's that safety net of the Roman Empire. I mean, I love this idea that you could just, I did it to another driver the other day. He cut me up, and I literally had my window down, and I did shout at him, I am a citizen of Rome, as in, like, get out of my way. And he just looked at me blankly, because I think he had the IQ of a spanner. But I mean, you do have that safety net of being part of this huge empire and the benefits that come with it. So it's got to be a pretty scary time for the British. Why do we look at the year 410 as if it's significant?
So the year 410 is one of these times where the province of Britain is emptied of troops. It's happened before. It happens in 383, happens in 407, happens again. And it's, so basically Rome is emptied Britain of troops in order to deal with, in 410, for instance, Alaric the Goth is about to sack Rome. It's the first time that Rome's been sacked by a foreigner since 390 BC. It's a horrible day in the history of Rome. And so troops are taken from Britain and they're not sent back. So there's a passage in a historian called Zosimus, and he talks about Honorius the Emperor sending a letter to the provinces of Britain saying, fend for yourselves. It's called the Rescript of Honorius, which is kind of something that people can latch onto and say, that's the date when Roman Britain is abandoned by Rome. So that's why 410 persists. And there's various usurpers around that time. There's a British usurper at that time called Constantine III. So he usurps technically in 407 and is only defeated in 411. So it's kind of in that time, but it's not exactly 410. And then other sources say, well, there was a previous usurper in the late 4th century named Magnus Maximus, and he also emptied Britain of troops. It's all complicated by the fact that we then have the Notitia Dignitatum, which is a list of officers of the Eastern and Western empires. And we think that the Western half of that document was written in around 420, so 10 years after the rescript of Honorius, and it lists tens of units of the Roman military that are still in Britain as the garrison troops, which causes all sorts of problems, because if there's Roman garrison troops in Britain, how can they still be there after Rome has abandoned Britain? So that's the first sort of, well, 410 might not be as finite as we think. And then we get later sources of the Britons appealing to Rome as late as 451 for assistance. And of course, by that time, Rome's dealing with Attila the Hun, another great invader, and so can't send any help to deal with Saxon and Jute and Angle invasions. So it's a much vaguer period of time when Rome actually abandons Britain. And we've now know from archaeological sources that there are Roman villas that seem to still have connections to mainland Rome right through until about 425, 430, 450 even, depending on the dates. So it's a phase that lasts about 40 or 50 years rather than a cut and dry date in 410. But again, many historians of the past have given that date of 410 as the sort of finalized, if you like, Brexit date. Sorry to bring Brexit up again. It's actually a very apt.
I do. Calendar. I love it. The fact that everything seems to fall apart, and that nobody really, everyone's like, "Ah, freedom! Oh crap! What do we do now?" Yeah, there's some days
there. Exactly.
I just also as well, I'm loving listening to Britain being the imperial subject, and not the other way around, because obviously I do much later history, and I'm thinking like, oh, so all right. The crap we did to other people was done to us at some point as well.
Revenge, yes.
Yeah.
Moving on from usurpers to, I don't know how you want to refer this, because some sources call him a warlord, some sources call him the first king of Britons.
I think he sounds like a Harry Potter villain.
Yes. He who shall not be mentioned.
Yeah.
His name is said and spelt in so many bloody... I'm going to go with what's been written, right? And that's Vortigern, not Vortigern. Oh, my God. There's so many different ways to say this and spell it. So I'm going to go with Vortigern. First of all, who was he and what was his role in the Saxon Jutish invasions?
Right. Well, it's a curly one, Vortigern. And it does indeed sound very similar to Voldemort. And there is this tradition that grows up around Vortigern that turns him into a king. But there's no evidence of a unified kingship in Britain at this time. And this complicates the picture of Vortigern and also, of course, King Arthur. So we're coming into the period under Vortigern when the historically King Arthur would appear. And so what it seems to be is that when Rome leaves, the British warlord kingdoms, possibly based on previous Roman forts and previous Roman centres, are seized by warlords. Now, one of the sources calls Vortigern a tyrannus superbus, so proud tyrant is how that sort of translates. So back in the earlier days of Roman history, you've got Tarquin the Proud, Tarquinius Superbus, who's the last king of Rome. So he's a proud tyrant, but our tyrant doesn't necessarily mean bad king the way we tend to think of the word tyrant. It can simply mean a man who seized power. And so it's highly likely that Vortigern seizes power in the vacuum left by Rome. So each one of the Roman provinces, and remember there's five or six of them, has a administrative network that either flees Britain when Rome abandons it, or stays in place and tries to keep things running on a sort of administrative level. This is all me postulating. There's no real evidence of that. And so I think that what happens is that in those various vacuums, various petty warlords seize power and try and take greater control of the area around where they seize power. And in that case, what Vortigern does is he's dealing with raids from the Picts, from the north, very independent tribesmen who reassert themselves as soon as Rome leaves. And in order to deal with those threats, he invites depending on which source you read, they're Saxon, or are they Jutish, or are they other, basically from the west coast of what is now the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, and Denmark. And so the Jutland Peninsula, and invites them over to be his mercenaries. And that's sort of seen as the first invasion. And the traditional date of that is 449 AD. Now, the issue with that is that it's not an invasion. They're invited in as mercenary forces, which is a very Roman thing to do. And so a leader hiring a mercenary force. So there's two ways that you can look at it. They're either what's called foederati, and a foedus or a foedus is a treaty. So you basically would hire these troops and say, you are going to fight for me for X period of time. In return, you will get paid XYZ, and you will provide this many men for me. And the other terminology, which is another mercenary sort of arrangement, is the laetus or the laeti, where they would be hired for a length of time. And so what Vortigern does is he hires Hengst and Horsa, who have very suspicious names, both connected with horses. They arrive with three ships, very suspicious. There's many invasions of Britain which happen with only three ships. But the fascinating thing with that is it's a small number of men. You know, if those ships had a crew of 40 each, it's only 120 crew who turn up as the mercenary force to defend what could be a very small area of land. And essentially, they turn against Vortigern and start to demand more land. They eventually get given Kent and form the Kingdom of Kent, and essentially establish their own foothold in Britain as an empire of their own that Vortigern is powerless to stop. And then the various sources talk about Vortigern and his son Vortimer and fleeing to strongholds in the mountains, the Welsh mountains, and it starts to become a Britain-wide empire that Vortigern has, whereas in fact I think it's very confined to the sort of southeastern tip of what is now England.
Okay, so who is Aurelius Ambrosius and how does he save Britain?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so there's another one of these big ones where, depending on which source you read, who is Aurelius Ambrosius? And he's connected in weird ways to King Arthur, and in some versions of the story, he's also a Merlin figure. So there's a whole legend which connects him to Merlin. And you're like, wait, what? So he's introduced in the sources as the last Roman, that his parents were Roman. His parents wore the purple, which some people interpret to mean that they were the emperors of Rome, or that they were the consul, which is one of the sort of administrative, you know, there's two consuls every year, even under the emperors, or more than two, but there's consuls every year. And so he sort of becomes a military leader. And I think he's another one of these figures who's probably a Roman who's asserting stays on in Britain and tries to assert some kind of control and bring some kind of order to a world that's sort of turned upside down. Various later stories connect him to a crown of England, which didn't exist at the time. So you get Aurelius Ambrosius, and then you get Constans and Vortigern, and they fight against him, and Uther Pendragon gets dragged in there as well. But he seems to be a military commander who fights against the invasions of the Saxons that start to come. And so he's a sort of a figure who we find cropping up in various different spots, fighting the Saxons. Some of the battles that he fights at are also later connected to the Arthurian legends. So he's connected to the actions of Arthur at the Battle of Mount Badon, for instance. We get a story that he fights for 3 days and nights. So does Arthur. So there's a really complicated sort of story of where he fits into this sort of picture. Some would like to see him as, and it's one of the things about a lot of this material in Britain, is that the sources come from various different parts of Britain. So we've got Nennius and Gildas, who are Welsh monks. We've got Bede, of course, who's a Northumbrian monk. And they're telling us their versions of the stories as they've received it. And so what you start to get is these figures who, as I said, I think Vortigern is very much a southeastern figure, starts to get associated with other areas of Britain. And similarly, Ambrosius also gets associated with other areas of Britain. And that's why even today you'll find various towns throughout Britain, from Cornwall all the way up to Scotland, who associate themselves with aspects of the story, especially with aspects of King Arthur.
I love how we've put King Arthur into this story, because we've had, I think we've had maybe two, Alex, was it three podcasts on King Arthur? My brain is frying.
Something here. Like that. We're at nearly 1,000 episodes now. We can be forgiven for not remembering
well,
one of them.
Well, 2,000's not too many, really. Two and a thousand's not too many. You're not overcoming it.
Us two trying to get away from 20th century history, just for the love of God. Everyone you know in the world of ancient history, send them our way.
Exactly.
Right. Lovely.
We've come across a lot, especially today on the podcast, where we touch, on Merlin and King Arthur and whatnot. But does the next person in our questions, which is, if I'm going to pronounce this completely wrong, Al?
I thought you were just going to dodge it and ask a different question so that one went down on me.
No. I thought I'd take the risk on this one.
Okay.
So Al then turns up with his sons. So at this point, we've got waves and waves of attacks and battles and all sorts of things. And how does this fresh Saxon attack affect the Britons?
What I think is happening is you've got Hengst and Horsa, who have been able to carve out an empire for themselves in Kent. And the Britons are too weak to defeat them, and they are essentially able to send back to their home territories in the Jutland Peninsula and say, this place is amazing, it's fertile, there's vast tracts of empty land, the locals can't defeat us, they're not able to stop us coming. Why don't you come over and set up your own empire? And so what I think happens is when Ella and his son, I say Ella, but it could be El, Cynric, and there's lots of them coming, which, Stuf and Witgar are fabulous names. But there's lots of these fabulous names of Saxon invasions, which then start to head towards Britain. And they land in what becomes Sussex, which is the kingdom of the South Saxons. And so I think they land at Clymenshaw, which is, I think, just outside of Pagham Harbour, I think is the modern name, south of Chichester. And so they essentially land again in three ships, and they defeat a sort of rabble that comes to try and stop them, and they establish a foothold on that area, and then they expand towards Pevensey. So by 491, they've expanded all the way to Pevensey from Clymenshaw, and that then becomes the Kingdom of Sussex. And you then start to get other invasions which carve out their own empires within Britain. And I think the fascinating thing there is that Britain, having been abandoned by Rome, is not powerless. There is resistance. And I think this is the picture that you get of figures like Ambrosius and figures like Arthur. They fit into the image of the invasions of the Saxons and other Germanic peoples, and there needs to be someone who is resisting them. And one of the issues with that, of course, is that one of the better sources from a later period is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Now, in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is established by King Alfred, and of course, firstly, is Alfred is descended from one of these kingdoms of the Saxons established. So it's all about giving him credibility and the royal bloodline, and also saying that the Saxon invasions were an unalloyed series of successes that never met with defeat. And the other picture, which is in the Arthurian tradition, is of a figure who defeats the Saxon invasions and never experiences defeat. So in Arthur, you have someone who fights the Saxons 12 times and never loses. And so they're the sort of competing images of the advance of these invaders and whether it was just success after success and empire after empire. So you get, you know, Port and his sons, and Port, we know Portchester is named after him. Another one, empire is established on the Isle of Wight. And then, you know, Mercia, Wessex, Sussex, Essex are all Saxon kingdoms that are eventually founded and eventually over the next few centuries are sort of merged until they become what we now know as England. And so that is an incredibly complicated picture. It's also for, you know, the tradition of Arthur and other figures, it's in the Dark Ages. You've had the end of Roman Britain, and so Rome leaves, you know, turning the light switch off as it goes. And we haven't yet got the light switch turned on in the medieval period, which generally in British history occurs with Alfred when he starts writing the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. So you've got this perfect window from 450 AD to, 878, where there's no light. So you can pretty much say what you like. And you, when you start to look at the medieval histories of Britain, they do indeed say what they like. They create these incredibly elaborate and fictional histories of Britain that, you know, didn't happen. There wasn't a unified kingship of Britain at this time. It was many petty warlords, many invaders, all establishing their own kingdoms, and they eventually get defeated by the bigger ones and eventually all merge into one. But it's a fascinating period of misinformation, if you like.
It is fascinating. Just trying to find what can we eke out of it, because I the visions in my head of all I know about this period is every time Tony Robinson and Time Team find what looked like it might have been a wooden post hole at some point in Saxon England, they get excited. But what can we say? What have we found out about what this meant to ordinary people on this island?
Well, I think the thing with ordinary people, of course, is that life pretty much continues regardless of who's ruling. And most family lives are about eking out an existence and growing food to eat. And that doesn't change. Obviously, there'll be privations and there might be ravaging foreigners, but then there could be ravaging locals too. So you might be called upon to form a militia to defeat the enemy of your local lord or an invader. But I think that for locals, they're essentially continuing their lives as they always did. And then a foreigner or a local king who's ambitious will come along and defeat the powerful, which probably will have some effect on you, but not the way we're sort of seen and we sort of see more spectacular versions of history on little screens and big screens that we do these days. The deprivations of these invaders, they're not going to be taking the everyday from those areas. Generally speaking, of course, they would either usurp your farms and you would work for them, but you're not going to have wealth to take. So It's a tricky one. Of course, it changes under the Vikings. And one of the things that happens, you know, the Viking Age doesn't begin until 793 when they attack Lindisfarne. But they of course, are taking slaves. And so they do indeed remove populations. But I think in terms of the Saxon invasions of post-Roman Britain, there coming into an area that probably was denuded of population because a lot of them had left when Rome abandoned. And we've got several sources which talk about the vast numbers of people from Britain who were moving to Europe. So it seems that, you know, Britain was in many ways empty. And so these Saxons turned up into tracts of land that were unclaimed, which is fascinating in itself.
Out of curiosity, because here on History Hack, we love to know about sources, as we do. Mm-hmm. And Alex had to bring in Time Team, of course, because we always have to bring in Time Absolutely. Team at this time period. But the question here is, what kind of sources do you have before Alfred?
So it's, again, a really interesting time period because you've got Roman historians. Now, when I say Roman, they tend to be a mixture of Western and Eastern Roman, what we now call Byzantine. But, of course, the Byzantines never called themselves Byzantines. They only ever called themselves Roman. So they were the Romans the whole time, all the way up until the fall of Constantinople in the 15th century. And I believe the term Byzantine only gets coined in the 16th century. Anyway, so you have figures like Zosimus and Procopius, who are sort of 6th century historians of Rome. And Britain's far away from where they're writing in Constantinople. So they're writing about bits of British history, but it's very liminal to them. And they give us weird, incorrect aspects of British history and you know, how wild the Scots are and things like that.
It's going to be like on a map so when you see Hebe dragons, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And but the shape is like the geographical location of Britain is always wrong. You know, it's basically off the coast of Spain. And, you know, the distance between the mouth of the Rhine and the coast of Britain's 20 states or you know, 30 kilometers. And you're like, no, it's a much longer. So that there's all sorts of confusion. But, of course, they're so far away, who's going to correct them? And so they're contemporary historians. So they give us some insights. We do have a contemporary historian in Gildas, who's a Welsh monk, and he writes a sermon on the ruin of Britain. And so he's deciding what's everything that's going wrong with Britain. You then have some Welsh annals. So one of the things about history at this time is you get an annalistic tradition where we will say everything that happens in the year. And so that's the tradition that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle continues, that this happens this year, these things happen, next year, these things happen, which is a really useful way for a modern historian to put things into a chronological order. The problem is, of course, there are many different annals of these different sources, and most of them have the same event in very different years, to the point that there is an argument that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle should actually be, we should change the dates of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle by 20 years. So everything that, you know, if the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says 449, we should actually say 429. If it says 470, it should actually be 450. And that's very hard to resolve. There's arguments for and against why you might change the chronology of those things. So there's lots of those. Then there's another source called the Welsh Annals, the Annales Cambriae. You then get poetry, mostly Welsh poetry. And so it's quite rich, the actual amount of written sources, very hard to handle. You do have archaeology, and I think one of the reasons that the people on Time Team get so excited about Saxon archaeology is that it's so rare to find, especially early Saxon archaeology. You know, in this 5th and 6th century, that's a very exciting thing to discover. And as we know from watching Time Team, more often than not, it's very vague if it actually is Saxon. You know, there's normally someone coming up saying, is it? Isn't it later? So there's that. And then, of course, you move into historians like Bede. And Bede, of course, is the first historian to use BC and AD dating. So every historian has a lot to thank / blame Bede for. And we start to get other historians like Nennius. And then you get this fascinating explosion of historians of Britain in the immediate post-conquest period. So in the 11th and 12th centuries, you start to get all of these historians of Britain who become incredibly influential. So William of Malmesbury, Geoffrey of Monmouth especially, Henry of Huntingdon, and Robert of Wendover. They write these histories of Britain, which are fascinating and competing with one another. Geoffrey of Monmouth has this one thing saying, he names all of the others who are competing with him, saying, you can write the history of later Britain, but don't dare, you know, speak of immediately post-Roman Britain, because I read a book that none of you have read. So leave it alone, I got it right. And yet when you read Geoffrey of Monmouth, he's got this fanciful version of English history that, you know, today we sort of scoff at, but for a long time it was believed hook, line and sinker.
I think this has been quite a fascinating talk. I think we have so much more we could cover, but I think...
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like I've just like shamelessly pumped Murray for information, because I'm like, oh, a corner of military history about which I know nothing. I'm going to get everything I can out of it because it's free and I don't have to pay a university to teach me it.
That makes well, this is the whole idea about podcasts though, right?
Yeah, and then we're going to get people to buy his book now.
Well, exactly.
Right. So, well, that'd be nice. That'd be nice. Yeah.
We learn things and we get book sales. So two birds, one stone.
Indeed. Absolutely. I think we should tell people. Go on.
I was going to say, I think raising more questions than you answer is always a good thing. I think, you know, if you read a book and rather than go, right, I know that now, you go, but hang on, what about this? I need to go and investigate that. I think that's one of the joys of being a historian.
You're always diving
down rabbit holes.
Indeed. And if we didn't, then we'd be out of a job. And that is the joy of it. But then there's obviously the pain of nobody thinking that it's a valuable skill and paying you enough for all the time you spend doing it. I think we're just going to... I want people to buy your book. The book is called Finis Britanniae. But I'm just going to tell people, Google Murray's name when you're looking for it. So it's M-U-R-R-A-Y, and his surname is D-A-H-M. I don't just want to spit the title out and people go, yeah, I can't spell that. So search Murray's name.
There's only me worldwide, as my daughters keep pointing out to me. It's like, are you the only Murray Dahmer? I am the only Murray Dahmer.
Awesome, which means you will be able to find him online if you do look for that. Please do buy book, because this is a fascinating topic, and I like, part of me's like, I love you people, you just get to go, yeah, there's no evidence, but I'm just gonna say I think this is what happened, because we don't get away with that in 1914 to 1945. We have pedants after us all the time going, a memo from someone. Like, I admired in World War I generals and their post-war memoirs where they try and absolve themselves of all blame in 1914 at the moment, and I've got material. I would really like there to be nothing so I can just say I think this happened, the end. But we don't get to do that, so do buy Murray's book.
Not do we, but we've got bigger gaps between our dots that we need to connect, shall we say.
Yeah, I think you get some pros and cons and we get different pros and cons. Thank you, Murray, for coming on. Please do buy his book. It's out now. Also as well, please do visit our Patreon page, kick a donation in on Ko-fi, do anything to support us because we are poor and my cat and her dogs have expensive tastes in food. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on. An absolute joy to talk to you, and a shame it has to end. But I understand that, you know, all good things must come to an end.
They do. And do come back and talk to us about any other rabbit hole that you like on ancient history, because Alina's headache. Yeah. If you are non-20th century, you will never get away from us, basically.
Oh, well, there you go. There you go.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.